Can I ask everyone to take their seats, please? We're going to begin with the next session, which is explaining algorithms and automation, a guide for lawyers. Speaking for myself, I'm going to need some help, I think, with this talk. Dr. Ruben Binns from the Department of Computer Science, University of Oxford, is going to be speaking to us. He is going to have some time for questions after his talk. Ruben.
Thank you. I am not a lawyer, I'm here to present the non-lawyer's view, although I did do my PhD in between computer science and law, so hopefully I'll have a sense of some of the things that might be interesting to you as I present this. So just to give you an overview of what I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to begin by trying to distinguish between digitization, automation, and decision-making. Then we're going to distinguish between rule-based systems and statistical systems. Then I'm going to talk about some of the ways that these statistical systems can lead to various forms of bias, error, and discrimination. Then I'm going to look at automation bias, which refers to the ways in which we as human decision makers who are using these systems to make decisions can react in biased ways. And then think about the ways in which the human decision maker, so this could be a case officer, a police officer, may have their discretion fettered or distributed unequally as a result of the deployment of these systems. So just to give you a bit of background, some of you may have read the Alston report, which was looking into the use of digital systems in welfare across the world. It found that in the UK, apparently one in three councils are now using algorithms to make welfare decisions. So what does all this mean? Well, I think first of all, we should distinguish between digitization, automation, and decision-making. So digitization could just mean digitizing previously paper-based processes. So the talk this morning talked about paper processes being replaced by digital ones. There's also automation of processes. So instead of a human looking at a date in a calendar and issuing a payment, you could have automatically recurring payments. And then there's a different category, which is the use of automated decision-making tools, either to support human decision makers or to make decisions automatically on their own behalf. So I'll give a few examples of those in a minute. But in the past, artificial intelligence systems were typically built using rule-based systems. So in a medical context, a medical expert would program the system with knowledge like the relationship between these symptoms and this disease. Or to take a completely random example, if you were trying to build an app to determine whether someone was eligible for settled status, you might say a rule like, if years in residence is over 5, then settled status eligibility equals true, if only it were that simple. Statistical systems, by contrast, they aim to classify, predict, or score new cases which haven't yet been classified or scored in a probabilistic way. So drawing from previous data, historical data, to try and predict what a new case will look like. So for instance, you might say, well, how similar is this particular benefits application to previous ones that were seen to be fraudulent? Or how likely is this particular person to reoffend based on statistics from previous cases? Or how risky is the person who is making this visa application? So what we have here is at a really simplistic level, we've got a bunch of data which contains variables that we want to use to predict an outcome, say in this case maybe it's salary. The outcome that we want to predict, which is whether or not the person will default, you apply a learning algorithm which automatically generates a statistical model from those variables and those outcomes. Now in a really simple case, something you could do by hand, you might just have two variables. So in case of a credit scoring model, you might have salary as one variable and the probability of default as another that you're trying to predict. And you plot your data points on that graph and you draw a straight line, and then you use that straight line to predict where future data points are going to fall. And this is a simple case that we could all understand, just using paper-based processes if we wanted to. Obviously, in reality, these systems are more complicated than that. If it were this simple, they probably wouldn't be so highly marketed and hyped in industry. So what are the differences? Well, so just to illustrate, this is an example of using a statistical model to make a decision automatically. So you set a certain threshold. So beyond this probability of default, we will automatically deny credit, for instance. So what is it that makes these systems more complicated than that? Well, one aspect is that they can be high dimensional. So rather than just considering one or two or three variables, they might consider many different variables at the same time and consider the interrelations between those variables. Another is that they could be very complicated. So this is a decision tree. A decision tree could be very complicated and allow for many different exceptions to exceptions to exceptions. So even though each individual branch in the tree might be kind of easy to understand, the overall picture is one that captures a great degree of complexity. Similarly, the graph I showed you before, we drew a straight line through the data points. But you could also have systems which don't do that. They can draw more complicated lines between data points. So some of those lines might not be straight, they might be wiggly. Some of them might go up as well as down. So what that means is that while one variable is related to another in a positive way for some values, for other values it might be negatively related. So for instance, as age goes up in the middle, you might be more credit worthy, and then as you get older and older, you become less credit worthy again, for instance. So that would be non-monotonic relationship. And then we have these new systems, which as far as I know, are not being used much in public sector, but they are being heavily marketed by the companies that make them. And these are referred to as things like deep learning. And the novelty here is that rather than simply using the features that you give them, so they might be the pixel values of the image, what they do is they try to infer additional features and additional structure in the data that isn't necessarily visible to the human eye. So it's about the relationships between variables, and that can be used to infer kind of latent variables. These are variables that are out there in the world that are the relationships between the variables that you feed to the system. And so the issue with these is that we don't really know what's going on in the system in these hidden layers. It's trying to infer additional information about the world that we haven't explicitly told it. And it uses that to make an inference. As I say, these aren't really being used in the public sector as far as I know, but they're certainly something that is being marketed for a variety of different uses. So I'm going to talk about some of the ways in which these statistical systems can embed quite important normative questions about, you know, how we exercise decision-making power. So first of all, I'll talk about the balance between false positives and false negatives. So this is best illustrated with the parable of the boy who cried wolf. So a false positive is the boy cried wolf, but there wasn't a wolf. That's a false positive, also called a type 1 error. A false negative or a type 2 error is what the villagers did the second time the boy cried wolf. So the villagers said, no, there's no wolf coming, but in fact there was a wolf coming. That's a false negative. And really, all statistical systems have to make a balance between these two kinds of errors. So to give an example, let's imagine we're trying to create a system which will predict whether or not somebody will reoffend if they're released from prison. So here we've got a bunch of data points. I haven't labeled the axis, but that might be, for instance, the age of the offender and number of days spent in prison, for instance. So we plot these data points on the axis. The ones that are circles, they're people who did not go on to reoffend. And the ones that are crosses are ones who did go on to reoffend. And if we look at this data, we can see there's a general pattern that the ones at the top right-hand corner are people who didn't go on to reoffend, and the ones in the bottom left-hand corner are people who did go on to reoffend. So if we're trying to create a statistical model, very simplistically, what we might do is just draw a straight line here. And what we're saying here is anyone above the line, any new data point that comes in that's above the line, we're going to predict that that person will not go on to reoffend. And anyone who falls below the black line, we're going to say that person probably will go on to reoffend. But obviously, the line isn't a perfect fit, because there are some cases where there are crosses above the line and there are circles below the line. What that means is that some people will be predicted to not reoffend who will go on to reoffend, and some people will be predicted to reoffend who don't go on to reoffend. So our false positive rate in this example is 3 out of 14. So we've predicted three people will not reoffend who do actually go on to reoffend, so that's about 1 in 5. Below the line, we have 6 examples of people who were predicted to reoffend who didn't. So that's a 1 in 4 false negative rate. So this isn't ever going to be perfect. And we could try to squeeze the line up into the higher up. And that would include, that would reduce our false positive rate a little bit. But it would also increase our false negative rate and vice versa. So we have to make this decision about what ratio should we be applying here. And so some of you may be thinking about Blackstone's ratio, where he said that it's better that 10 guilty people escape than one innocent person suffers. This is essentially the same kind of decision that the designers of these systems or those who are procuring these systems have to make. How important is it to avoid falsely keeping someone in prison when they wouldn't go on to reoffend versus not? So these are all examples of the balance between false positives and false negatives. Second problem, so return to this example. So let's say we're trying to predict who's going to reoffend or not. What we're doing here is we're trying to create a line of best fit for the population that we have. But it might be that there's a subset of the population for whom the correlations are different, or for whom the distributions of variables are different. So I don't know if you can see, but there's about 8 or 9 examples there which are in red, and the rest are in blue. Can you see that? So the red examples all fall below the line. But if you actually count them, if you're from this red population, you're less likely to reoffend than the general population. But the system we've done, which is meant to fit the general population, is actually predicting that all of the red population are going to reoffend, when in fact they're less likely than the general population to reoffend. So what we could do is maybe draw the line differently. We could potentially draw 2 different lines, which would allow a better fit for the red population. But again, this is a difficult value-laden choice that we have to make. And that red population, that might be female prisoners. It might be people for whom a different type of offence has been committed and where the relationships between the variables are different. Finally, there is the problem that the data that we feed to these systems is going to reflect the structures of discrimination, marginalisation, oppression that exist in society. So in a society which is rife with gender bias, racial bias, we're going to be training our system on the same data. And so that is going to result in systems which potentially compound the same problematic structures. So to give you an example, again, let's imagine we're trying to predict reoffense. Let's say we have one variable which we're using to predict, which is the number of prior offenses. So probably the more time someone has committed an offense in the past, the more likely they are to go on to reoffend in future. But unfortunately, what we don't have is actual rates of offense, right? So what we have is prior arrests and maybe prior arrest and conviction rates, which are not the same thing, right? So not all offenses result in arrests and convictions. Not all arrests and convictions are the result of offenses. So our data is actually a proxy for the thing we really care about. And that affects both the thing we're using to predict the outcome and the thing we're using to measure the outcome. So both the prior arrest rate is affected by this proxy, and as well as the rearrest rate. So to use an example from the US, in the US, Caucasian Americans and African Americans use marijuana at roughly the same rate, but African Americans are much more likely to be arrested for possession of marijuana. So that dynamic is going to affect both the data we have on prior arrests and the data we have on rearrests. So if we deploy this kind of model, it's going to over-predict the rate of reoffense for African-American defendants. And the same kinds of dynamics are likely to play out in the UK context, where there are similar disparities in things like stop and search. And to go back to what I mentioned earlier about these deep learning systems, what they're very good at is inferring hidden structure in the data that maybe reflects dynamics that are going on in the real world beyond the data. And as I said, it's very difficult to know what those additional latent features might be, but it's possible that if there are gender biases, in the data that we're using, or racial biases in the data that we're using, those will be picked up, the patterns of discrimination in the real world will be picked up by the system in ways that might be very hard for a data scientist or an engineer to audit. So computer scientists and others have been trying to think of ways to measure these kinds of biases in systems. So one might be to say, well, if the error rate between different protected classes is the same, then that's a good thing. Others might say, well, they should be equally well calibrated. So if the system thinks that someone is risky, it should turn out that they are risky. And that calibration should be equal between, say, men and women or black and white defendants. Problem is that while these different measures are plausible, it turns out that they can't be satisfied at the same time. It's mathematically impossible to satisfy both at the same time. So again, there is these difficult choices that have to be made about which kinds of measures to prioritize, if any. So I'm going to move on now to talk about the ways in which, as these systems are deployed on the ground and given to human decision makers, they can interact with existing forms of bias in interesting and problematic ways. So first of all, there's this distinction between decision support, which I drew earlier, where you're providing information to a decision maker, which is not in itself meant to make the decision. The decision maker is meant to factor that information in, whether it's a risk score or a classification or a prediction, into their own decision. And they're supposed to use their own judgment, their own discretion, and contextual information about the situation to come to a decision. Alternatively, you might deploy these systems in a fully automated way. So that would mean the system itself makes a decision and takes action in relation to a person. And for those of you who are familiar with data protection, this is important for the scope of Article 22 of the GDPR, which treats these different kinds of systems differently. So here's a figure to illustrate. So you've got fully automated cases where new cases come in. Automated processes divide cases into one outcome or the other. Decision support cases, the same thing happens at the initial stage, but rather than going straight to an outcome, it's put before a human who then exercises their own judgment and decides on an outcome. Now, there's been a lot of research in human-computer interaction over many decades, which looks at automation bias. So this is the biases that humans may exhibit after being exposed to an automated system, and particularly in the case of piloting systems. So there's two kinds of problems. One is that the pilot or the decision maker may under-rely on the computer output, so ignore the output of the computer where it is actually good information that it should be using. Or they might over-rely, so they might effectively look at what the computer says and say, well, I'm going to agree with the computer because I don't know anything better, and they effectively rubber stamp the computer's decision. It turns out that these can be at play at exactly the same time in different ways. So this is a case from the introduction of risk scoring in Kentucky, where a risk score of a defendant is used by judges to make decisions about bail. So you can see there's a point in the middle of this graph. That's the date at which these risk scores were introduced. And it turns out that, yes, they did have an effect on the judges, so the judges were paying attention to these scores. But it turns out that depending on the race of the defendant, the judge was factoring into account the risk score differently. So if the defendant was white, the judges appear to be deferring to their own discretion and their own judgment. If the defendant was black, they tended to defer to the risk score of the algorithm, and usually in a less lenient way. A similar dynamic is at play, I think, in this case, which is an interesting report from the Inspector of Borders and Immigration. So this was an inspection of the Croydon office for visa entry and the Istanbul office. And I think this illustrates an interesting couple of issues, some of which are similar to the previous one. So in this case, there's this risk score of green, amber, or red, depending on how risky the system thinks the visa application is. And depending on the color of the risk score, the case may get deferred to a different caseworker or a different department. So the more risky cases might get seen by people with particular expertise in that area. So here you have a situation where the upstream automated step is determining which caseworkers get to see and get to assess the system. What's interesting is in the Istanbul office, they introduced a new category called super green. So this is those applications which are deemed to be very, very low risk. When I presented this to someone the other day, they said, should it be called the super white category? Because we can imagine the demographics of the kind of people who will be given the super green status. But here you have two interesting things going on. So one is that the in some cases, the risk score means that there is very little or no human judgment exercised. And so there's an automatic approval of the visa application. In other cases, the human decision-making is effectively fettered by the upstream automated process. So if you are given a red score or a green score, you'll be placed in front of a different set of caseworkers who may have different outcomes available to them. So if you're placed in the group of the human decision makers who only can give you outcome 3 or 4, which might be, you know, denied or subject to more intensive checks, that means that those humans, while they are making the final decision and they may be exercising discretion, they don't have the same degree of unfettered autonomy to make the decision as they would have done otherwise. I'm going to end with a final question, which I don't know a good answer to, but I think is probably one of the most important questions for considerations of these systems in the context of judicial review, which is, where is the decision being made? As I understand it, this is one of the crucial questions, right? What we have here is examples of systems where the decision isn't made in any one particular point. There's no one particular person who is making a decision necessarily, recording all of the reasons for the decision. The decisions are actually the result of various systems interacting with each other. And also the way that these systems are configured, the level of the discretion, the level of automation bias, whether it's under-reliance or over-reliance, all of these things could have quite an important impact on whether we determine the decision to be made upstream or downstream, or how holistically we consider the case. So I think I will end there to leave extra time for questions. Great, thanks.
Could we follow the same process that we followed with Mrs. Justice Cockerill? So if you have a question, could you please raise your hand so that the people with the mics can come towards you? Yes, the lady over here and the lady over here. And if we take both of the questions, and then Ruben, if you could give your answers. Go ahead.
Hello, Sweelang Harris from the Legal Education Foundation. Thanks very much for your talk, Ruben. I was just wondering if you would be able to talk through some of these concepts and issues in the context of the facial recognition case that we heard about earlier in the day. And I think in particular, number one, understanding how the system makes its decision about the match between a face and someone on the watch list, and secondly, interrogating how the police officers might have been interacting with that system in the context of where is the decision being made. Thanks.
Melanie Carter, Bates Wells. My question is possibly ends up being a comment, but as these sorts of public sector decisions become more and more complicated, particularly the where and who and what happened, and therefore it becomes more opaque and more difficult for would-be claimants to understand what may have gone wrong, I'm wondering whether the courts are inevitably longer term going to have to become, in the administrative law space, more inquisitorial, actually, or whether we're going to end up needing a new regulatory body who can take over that inquisitorial role.
Okay, so on the question of facial recognition technology, I think in terms of the opacity, the problem that I mentioned about, you know, these deep learning systems that are inferring hidden features that we can't necessarily interpret ourselves, I think the facial recognition case is interesting in that sense, because it at the very least, we can imagine the kinds of things that it's inferring, right? So it's inferring things like distances between facial features. It's inferring, you know, image aspects of the image which we as humans may not be able to do, or we may be able to do because we're very good at recognizing faces, but we don't know how we do it. So in that sense, there's a similarity there. I think where there are potentially issues of opacity is, well, how diverse was the training set that was used to develop the facial recognition system? Is the watch list that's being used to match faces against overpopulated by certain parts of the population and therefore more likely to lead to a false match? So I think those are the really important questions there. Whereas in other cases, it's potentially much harder to understand what the hidden features might be if you're using, you know, demographic data as the basis of your decision making. In terms of the human in the loop, I do think that, again, facial recognition is an interesting and potentially less problematic case because humans are, in general, well, there's a diversity on this issue, humans are in general very good at doing face recognition. We're trained to do it. We've evolved to do it. The police do employ super recognizers for certain cases. But in general, the human oversight there, it's obvious what the human is doing. It's checking for errors. And while, you know, humans are going to potentially exhibit their own biases in terms of being able to recognize faces that they're more familiar with, at the very least, we understand what kind of information they should be relying on. And it's less tricky than in cases where the caseworker may not even have the supplementary information that they need to assess the case. In terms of the question about whether judicial review processes will need to become more inquisitorial, I think that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure what the answer is. I think there is a session later on evidence and the use of evidence in these cases, which may touch on those questions. I think there will need to be different skills deployed, because these systems are, in theory, highly auditable. In theory, it should be possible to completely reconstruct the system as it was at the time when the decision was made. Obviously, the issues I raised about how these systems are deployed in practice and used in different ways by human decision makers interacting in complicated ways with existing prejudices or biases, and the existing parts of the process which aren't automated, will raise additional challenges. I think the challenges will also be around where these systems are procured by external third-party providers who don't necessarily provide their clients, in this case public sector, with the kinds of ability to scrutinize the systems that they would need in order to satisfy themselves that they're being used in the correct way, and also should it come to a judicial review, that it can be scrutinized in that context as well.
I think we have time for one more question. Yep.
Hi, it's Craig Melson from Tech UK. Do you think there could be at some point where people subject to these decisions can challenge the algorithms and the models used in appeal cases and in trying to get the decisions overturned? Do you think that could be kind of, an extra layer of the appeals process, or an extra layer for redress?
I'm not sure the answer. I'll wait for another question.
Let's just take that one. Thank
I'm not sure the answer to that. I think it's an interesting one, though, because if part of the overturning of the decision involves overturning the algorithm that led to the decision, that means that every similar case will then be decided similarly in future, which is not the case when there's a human decision maker. You can overturn the one decision, but that doesn't necessarily mean that future decision makers will necessarily decide in the same way. When you change a system like this, you change it for everybody who's got the same set of input features. So it's not really an answer, but it's just to highlight that the consequences of how we decide that are going to be quite big, because they affect how the system will operate in future downstream.
Okay, unfortunately we're out of time, but if you could join me in thanking Ruben. Thank you.